Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. Have accessed entry 1094.GN3912, certificate number 44390. Sadie Hawkins Day.
Little lad, now we has both learned, still don't know how money gets earned. His heart is the tenderest,
but neuter gender as far as young gals is concerned.
I get pretty tired of running. Daisy May,
which leads us to say it's a typical day. Pick up as you and pay.
Now, we don't know what order the far future post-humans are listening to these entries in.
Are you saying they're not listening? Maybe they're listening in numerical order.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like maybe Sadie Hawkins comes right after Sack Lunches and Sabbath, comma Black for them.
Right. Hey, don't foreshadow any of the shows I'm going
to
do.
I hate to spoil. I don't know why you didn't just alphabetize it under Black Sabbath, but okay. Perhaps. I mean, it's a reference work. Sometimes you just pull a reference book down from the shelf and page through it in order. Sometimes you're looking something up.
Sure, you thumb through it, or you go right to what you're.
And I've never thought about that. Some 20-legged centipede man going to his shelf of omnibus gold records because he suddenly has a question about
Sadie Hawkins Day
or Chinook jargon or whatever.
Right.
This is a case where I had never heard of Chinook jargon, despite being a Seattle native, until you mentioned it on the last show we recorded. Because we do have a chronological order. We're three-dimensional beings.
Right. I didn't, you know, one of the things I didn't mention was Haida jargon, which is a different trade language of the Pacific Coast Native Americans.
Is it like a Haida bed? Like, that's why you didn't talk about it? It was all folded up in the couch?
No, you know, the Haida were the most raiding, warlike tribes of the Northwest Coast, and they ranged far and were...
Are they north of the Chinook?
Yeah.
Are they like...
Yeah, they're...
What's today British Columbia, Alaska?
Alaska Panhandle. Mm. And they were like slave takers and village burners. So I'm guessing that the Haida jargon was a little bit more like, well, you know, phrases like get on your knees and...
Right. Instead of having 60 words for snow, they had 60 words for bloody snow.
Yeah.
Well, and that's great. Do you have anything more you want to say about Chinook jargon while we're doing...
Well, you know, we'll add it to our addenda episodes, which are available to our Patreon
Delightful
subscribers.
Monthly fun we have on Patreon.
That's right.
Because people from our era do contact us with suggestions and stories they've thought of, and we have a lot of fun with that.
Right.
Would you like to add anything to the AA episode? Do you have another hour on Alcoholics Anonymous?
Listen, I have a lot of thoughts about that, and we may have to pull that out of the regular feed because I need to rethink that. I need to rethink that episode.
I feel like I got my 2-hour chip just doing that show. Anyway, I had never heard of Chinook jargon before, much less Haida jargon. Mm. You're just inventing new jargons all the time, and I think you're pranking
me. I have indie rock jargon.
Is it that grunge lexicon? Catch you on the flippy flop, John.
Wax lax.
But there's a scenario whereby if you hear about something new and then suddenly it seems to be everywhere in your life. Mm-hmm. It's often called Bader-Meinhof phenomenon. I'm not sure why, because it makes you blow up a bank in Frankfurt or something.
I don't see how Bader-Meinhof, which I should do an episode on.
Right. That will be in the... Once we've mentioned it, by the way, you will start hearing about Bader-Meinhof and Bader-Meinhof phenomenon everywhere.
I always think of it as the Volkswagen bug phenomenon, which is, at least this used to be true. If you noticed a Volkswagen bug and really took notice of it, like, oh, right, a Volkswagen bug.
Those exist.
Then you would see them everywhere. And it's true also if you buy an interesting car.
Exactly.
Suddenly you realize, oh, I got a Nissan Sentra and they're everywhere.
I just assumed the bugs were reproducing, like that I'd gotten close to a nest.
But something happened and they became sterilized by the additional UV rays.
Yeah, once they started making the weird fancy ones, those are mutants.
Totally mutants, and I don't think people are buying them. Like when they first came out, it seemed like they were very popular.
Yeah, people were delighted that the Beetle was back, but
I don't see
they're
them
just
very
kind
often
of mis- and they're turning more and more into regular cars. It is like mutants, like because every generation the cloning gets further away from the cute 60s Beetle shape.
They're not cute anymore. I don't know why they did that.
But just today, while preparing to record an omnibus about Sadie Hawkins Day, mm-hmm. I found that there's a very direct Chinook jargon connection. This is Chinook jargon part two, basically.
Okay.
And I learned that I knew, in fact, a couple of words of Chinookwawa, which I didn't know. Apparently, the expression high muckety muck.
Yes.
Which I don't think of as a local Seattle thing. Doesn't the world have high muckety mucks?
Well,
it's just a way of saying grand poobah or, big shot.
It does, but the terminology comes from Chinook jargon.
Yeah, it was hayu mucka muck.
Yeah.
And hayu did not mean high. It just meant, means plenty of food. So a powerful person, a big shot is just in that era, the well-fed
high mucky muck
trader. Yeah.
Well, we know also, I'm sure you know that the term Skid Row comes from Seattle.
Yes, but not via Chinook, right?
It's No. It was Yesler Way. They actually skidded the logs down the muddy slope.
Lumber towns would have a Skid Row where you would skid the... Although skid has always seemed like not the verb I would use. Why isn't it Slide Row or...
Well, it's like 23 Skidoo. It was
Things were skidding more back then.
They skidded a lot, yeah.
As was the style at the time. The other word... that I learned that I already knew of Chinook, we will get to in due course discussing Sadie Hawkins dance. It's a 20th century American tradition, which I think still persists today, of there being one occasion in the year when the girls can ask out the boys.
Yes. One day, this celebrated and nerve-wracking day where the girls ask the boys.
Which really makes it fair, if you think about it.
Yes.
They didn't used to have a day. Yep. Now they do.
Thank
and
goodness.
Gender parity has been
Thank
achieved.
Goodness the girls get a day.
This is an older tradition than Sadie Hawkins has existed. There was, in the 19th century, there was a tradition of leap day, I believe, February 29th, or maybe, so once every 4 years. You can see how much progress we're making. Mm-hmm. Once every 4 years, the women would be able to ask out the men.
Oh, because it was a leap day. It was some kind of crazy upside down day.
It's a topsy-turvy-dom.
Uh-huh. You wear your shirts backwards like crisscross.
What's the weirdest thing you can imagine? A woman expressing interest in a man. And that. What if that happened?
It's still astonishing to consider.
And so it was a comic trope, and there'd be maybe slightly naughty postcards of showing kind of spinster aunt-looking women and homely sisters-in-law with big butterfly nets, and and the men are running scared. I mean, the Battle of the Sexes was much more of a battle in olden times, I think, looking at this stuff.
Big Ethel was chasing Jughead around the malt shop.
Yeah, it's a stereotype we don't have so much because it's really not a good look.
Have you seen a recent Archie comic? Big Ethel has been de-ethelized to the point that she looks very much like the other people in Archie.
Are these the ones that are still drawn in kind of the Dan DiCarlo Archie style, or are these the modern ones where they kind of look anime and Archie's in a, you know, just always got his guitar?
They look similar enough to the old style, but everyone's features. I mean, there's been a rush to the middle, so everybody kind of looks at least more alike than before. I mean, Big Ethel used to be drawn in the Ichabod Crane style of spinster aunt, tall and flat chested and buck toothed, and now she just looks like she's one modicum taller than Betty.
Is Moose different? Because obviously this is a gendered problem we have with this stereotype that we've created of the hapless, homely person. It you know, that really only cuts one way.
I haven't seen the Moose and Midge dynamic. I'm not actually consuming these Archie comics. I just saw them at one point because I was...
It's weird how often you mention them for a non-consumer.
I was searching Big Ethel, actually, trying to see what had happened.
Trying to find her number.
Yeah. But I didn't look
Ethel,
into the Moose Midge dynamic because that was also a real... you know, a dynamic of that would have been either comedic or commonplace in ye olden times, which was the big dumb boyfriend who was extremely jealous of his tiny little dark haired girlfriend who was
it's in Moonraker, right? Yeah. Jaws and the little tiny 4 foot nothing girl who cottons to him.
But Midge was always sort of chastely flirty with all the other boys. It seemed like Midge was always inspiring some jealousy on the part of Big Moose. Just again for the comedic value, but I'm not sure how they could be playing that in contemporary Archies.
I can't get over the fact that this stereotype never really had any pathos to it. It was strictly for yucks. Look, this girl can't get a date. Like what's funny about that? I mean. Like, it seems like the obvious place to go there is to kind of, you know, show us her inner life.
Yeah.
And nobody particularly cared to do that.
No.
Look, I mean, she's 28 and she's not married. What a loser.
Oh, wow. I'm looking at the new drawings of Archie and it's awful.
Are these the kind of ones where Archie's kind of a James Dean type and it's not drawn in the old-timey style?
Well, I mean, I'm just seeing, there's so many different Archies now, man. It's just like...
Yeah, it's Crisis on Infinite Archies.
Yeah.
There's a multiverse of Archies.
Anyway, you know, Archie, there were a lot of situations where the girls asked out the boys in Archie, right? Betty was always kind of working some angle. Veronica didn't ask so much as demand.
Yeah, that is, and it seems like maybe Betty is more likely to try to use her, whatever you would call, I feel like there's a name for this in feminist discourse, like the soft power that the women are allowed to exercise.
Right.
Kind of power behind the throne, power of suggestion.
Betty is smarter than Archie, but also in his thrall.
But she has to work. She has to work out a way for him to feel like he took the initiative.
That's right. Exactly.
She would say, why haven't you asked me to the dance? Which is isomorphic to let's go to the dance. But for some reason, she can say the first thing. But not the second thing.
Well, and Archie's a ginger too, which is the number one reason this whole thing has to be impossible.
I'm glad there is still one okay lookist take.
Oh, absolutely. You can still be racist against gingers. Although we'll get tons of letters.
Not ugly people, but so you have you ever had the experience of being like as a young person? Were you ever pursued by a woman in Sadie Hawkins type fashion?
Yeah, I mean,
do you prefer to be the questing knight?
I think I would prefer to be asked out, frankly.
100%
me. When I was in elementary school, I remember a girl came up to me on the playground and said that another girl, her friend, wanted to go out with me. And I had never heard that terminology. I moved to Anchorage from Seattle right before fifth grade, moved permanently. And my upbringing in Seattle was pretty sheltered, right? I looked at some pictures of my elementary school from kindergarten to fourth grade, and there weren't any children of any other race besides blonde. Like, honestly, there was one kid that was like Italian, and everyone else was just the whitest kids.
Yeah, because you were raised in the 1870s.
I was raised in North Seattle, Shoreline, Washington, in the 1970s. But then I moved to Anchorage, and suddenly I had tremendous diversity in my school and in my classes. There were Native Alaskan kids. There were kids of every race and every economic background, which had not been true in Shoreline.
Because Alaska was some kind of a magnet, maybe, for people of all types looking for work or...
Yeah, Alaska is the frontier. And so it was a place of encounter. There were Native Alaskans of every kind, right? There were Athabascan Indians and Aleuts and...
Were there Haida?
Not in my school.
With stone hatchets?
Not in my school.
Bullying you at recess?
They were a more southern people than Anchorage. But there were also, because of the Air Force and the Army, there were people from all over, and then the oil companies brought people from all over. And so it was also my elementary school, a place of encounter for me. And
how had you not heard of Going Out, though? Like, how had you not seen an episode of Love Boat or something?
I just didn't know the phrase. I mean, I understood. I probably, if she had said go steady, I would have gotten it. But like, she wants to go out with you. And I said, go where? And the little girl that was the messenger laughed right in my face. And then that became an anecdote that she went around the playground and said, he said, go where?
But that's a reasonable question. If I asked somebody out and they said, where would you like to go? I would not think, what a weirdo. I would think, roller skating? The movie theater?
But I think it was clear by the way that I answered that I didn't know what she was talking about. And I was like, she wants to go out where? Like, I didn't take it as a date offer.
It was like, go outside.
Go out to the... We were outside at the time. We were on the playground.
That's more so I was out like, than the playground.
Go out? What do you even mean? And I did not end up going out with that girl because I became a laughingstock as a result of it.
I, too, have a preference for being told in advance that someone is interested.
Hey, Ken.
And this is not I almost think this is probably a majority opinion with men, and yet we're still dealing with this fossilized courtship scenario whereby that's not smiled on.
It didn't happen and anywhere close to how I would have liked it. And what was way more common in my life was that someone wanted to go out with me and waited for me to ask, and I never did. And they felt rejected. And also I never went out with them, even in cases where I wanted to.
This is a common scenario. And I think often usually a man realizes decades later, oh, she was really into me. She didn't actually just keep touching my shoulder because I had lint, or she didn't actually, you know, pretend to take up this hobby. You know, wait, for 10 years she was interested in me, and then at the time somehow
I've written numerous emails to people going, wait a minute, could we have gone out? And they've replied, yes, dummy. And so it's one of the
missed opportunities.
It's part of the trauma that drives me.
I feel like it only happened to me once in college where somebody said, haven't you noticed my roommate's totally into you?
Right. And I would have assumed it was a college counselor or your a professor.
The professor, really? That's not one of his or her duties. But this was a case where I had really never had any suspicion or interest, but just hearing that, suddenly I was like, oh, does she? Suddenly I'm interested. Like I was this harmful trope of the romantic object that can be pursued and persuaded. You know, the rom-com thing that has wrecked so much havoc in our culture. Right. The fact that if you're just persistent enough, you can get her to like you. But it turned out I am absolutely her.
Like, you're like, me?
Wow. Oh,
all of a sudden I see her.
Yes. No, we did not. And I think she moved or something. It was not my wife. She had to be persuaded.
Your wife is the first girl you ever kissed.
First and last. She was a girl who was not at all interested in going out with you. And what was in fact deploying roommates the way submarines deploy counter measures to to distract me and dissuade me. Please tell him not to ask me out. But luckily I had seen
Hunt for Red October.
I was going to say while you were sleeping or something. I had seen enough romantic comedies to know that I just needed to persist.
My romantic life is 100% dominated by submarine tactics. Cold War submarine tactics.
Yes, except you're just doing the silent caterpillar drive thing.
Right. Run silent, run deep.
And the Russians never find you. And eventually you get back to port alone and unloved. But the origin of Sadie Hawkins as a one day a year thing, did you have Sadie Hawkins dances?
We did have Sadie Hawkins dances in high school.
We did too.
And in college, because I went, the first 2 years I went to a Jesuit college, which prided itself on still being mostly in the 1950s. So both places we had Sadie Hawkins days, and I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. I'm going to pull down the curtain on it and say, I was never asked.
I was also never asked. And I was never at a school where there was much of a culture of it. The Sadie Hawkins dance was theoretically the dance where the girls could ask the guys, but really it never ended up happening. Dances were more go hang out with your friends and ask who you were standing near to dance.
Yeah, lean against the wall until someone like feels so guilty, so forced. I like lean against the wall and the girls would lean against the other wall and stare at you and then look away and you'd be like, I don't, why is she staring at me?
They're literally battle lines. Like the Battle of the Sexes literally had sides like a Shelby Foote diagram of a Civil War battle. One wall of the gym and the other wall of the gym.
Right. And then in the middle, there were the brave or shameless kids that were like dancing. Ugh.
What do they think they're doing?
I really feel terrible even thinking about it.
Yeah. No one ever has. How come no one has good memories from high school dances?
I'm thinking back to.
They should be banned.
Yeah, right. I mean, high school dance. I mean, later, I guess in high school when I had a good group of friends and we all went to the dance together, boys and girls, mm-hmm. it was easier then because I had five lady friends that we could dance with one another and it wasn't weird. But like I started going to dances in seventh grade. I remember Leaning Against the Wall. I can remember the songs. They played Another One Bites the Dust. They played Working in a Coal Mine.
Wait, what?
By Devo. I mean, like, I remember the playlist very distinctly because I was leaning against the wall just in total mortification. And the music was something I could, like, focus on. Also, how do you dance to Another One Bites the Dust?
Yeah.
Another One Bites.
Those are, like, both songs for an assembly line.
Yeah. 1984 style, like dystopian. They might have even played We Don't Need No Education, right? Like, but it was a weird time in music.
Yeah, when Pink Floyd is dance music, it's a weird time.
Yeah.
The origin of the Sadie Hawkins dance actually is in universities. It started there and percolated down to high schools. But it all begins with what used to be the center of American mass culture, the newspaper comic page.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you and I are on the record as being fans of the newspaper comic.
Oh, man. I cannot overstate how much the newspaper itself and also the comics influenced me and shaped me.
And anyone 5 years younger than us thinks we're crazy. We were the tail end of that, of the newspaper's arrival being an event and having specific pages where we knew where our stuff was.
Yes.
You can't start your homework before you've read Broomhilda,
right?
Or done the jumble or checked the Sonics box score. I mean, I had many newspaper related traditions related to whatever I was interested at the time. Maybe for some kids it's stock prices or.
I only just now, as you said it, get that Broomhilda was Brunhilda. I never, ever put that together until this very second.
But she's a witch, you see.
She's a witch.
Broomhilda was actually created by a cartoonist named Elliot Kaplan, who suggested it to Russell Myers, who ended up drawing the strip. And Elliot Kaplan was the brother of Alfred Gerald Kaplan.
Al Cap?
Better known in his cartooning life as Al Cap.
No kidding.
Do you have any memory of Al Cap's
work? Absolutely. I've seen, I think, on your wall, on your amazing wall of media, some Al Cap omnibuses.
I don't think I have any Al Cap books, although I do have many of the cartoonists, you know, his contemporaries like Milton Caniff and others he influenced, like Walt Kelly of Pogo. But he was...
Oh, you're a Pogo consumer. I know that about you.
Huge Pogo fan. It was a way to trick little children into embracing leftist politics by having bears and ducks and washing bears tell them that McCarthy was bad.
So Al Cap drew Little Abner, and you're saying his brother was did Broomhilda?
His brother was better known for The Heart of Juliet Jones, one of these soap cartoons that I never read.
No, I didn't read that.
Why didn't we read those?
Well, they weren't in the newspaper. They weren't in my newspaper.
Well, we had Apartment 3G and maybe Mary Worth, didn't
we? I know,
we?
But I had both of those, but reading them is just such a slog. Like, nothing ever happens.
That's really the problem. The first two, there's always three panels. The first two summarize the previous day's strip, and then one is like, and then the phone rings, and then Mary's thought balloon is like, who could that be?
Who could that be? Right, and you're like, ugh. There's no jokes, there's no...
And we were okay with slow-moving entertainment then. Yeah. We watched Mr. Rogers, but this was too slow even... For Gen X.
Well, I would watch Bloom County stories unfold over the course of a month and a half, but at least at least the Penguin slipped on a banana peel.
I feel like the Spider-Man strip that Stan Lee drew was the only serialized strip I actually drew, because you thought something might happen, and it really rarely did. Some bank robbers or something.
But you're absolutely right. The newspaper arriving on the porch was an event. When it wasn't there, it threw the entire day into a sideways state, and I immediately went through the newspaper and gathered the things that mattered to me and read them as soon as possible, and without them the day felt a little bit empty.
There would be family disagreements over who had which page.
That's right.
And who got it first.
My mom and I were very good about, we would sit together and she would be reading one section, I'd be reading the other, and we would then trade sections, often without looking at each other.
You and your mom are a 70-year-old married couple at some Upper East Side diner.
We really were. But I did check the stocks, because when I was, I think, maybe in sixth grade, my mom bought me two stocks, and one of them was in a company called Instrument Systems.
It seems fake.
And Instrument Systems made some instruments.
And I'm guessing also some systems.
They did, and it was space travel related. And it was a penny stock, and I got 100 shares, and it was, 100 shares for whatever, $10. But I...
More like a dime stock then.
It was a little bit of a dime stock. And it fluctuated. I looked at it every day, and it fluctuated between 10 and 15 cents a share for years. And I would go to that stock page and I would find Instrument Systems, and I was waiting for it to shoot up to $100 a share, at which point I would be rich. And eventually Instrument Systems fell apart. I guess the company just
delisted
and didn't. Aww. I don't think it, I mean, surely.
You're going to look it up right now and find out that it is SpaceX and that you're a billionaire, and then you're not going to do the show anymore.
Instrument Systems. Oh, there is a company called Instrument Systems. It says here it's
piano tuners.
They bring quality to life. No, it's a German optical company.
That's not as interesting as space travel.
Here's their slogan. Discover. Oh, it changed.
The slogan changed?
No, they have one of these terrible websites where it's just like, ugh, they were showing me the first one and then, oh wait. No, their slogan is, we bring quality to light.
Finally, somebody's bringing quality to light.
Innovative light measurement technology. Okay, and it looks like this is the same logo, so maybe...
Wow, they're still around?
Oh, it's part of the Konica Minolta group. So it's, it got bought out.
Well, then maybe you have a huge share in, Minolta, another probably not very successful
Sure, company. But it's possible that the stock has split like 500 times, and you're right, I'm a wealthy guy now.
Somebody's crisscrossing Alaska trying to find... is there a John Roderick still here?
Waving this stock certificate in the air.
You really can't overstate how many just regular parts of daily life were impossible without a printed newspaper.
Yeah.
There was no other way to know what was on TV.
The weather.
There was no other way to know if it would rain tomorrow. There was no other way to know what time the movie was if you were going to go to a movie.
It was the only way to know what the breaking news was until the 7 o'clock news.
That's right.
Or the 6 o'clock news.
For tomorrow's marketing, you would want to, you know, whoever was doing the shopping would be looking at that to see if flank steak was going to be on sale at which store.
Sports.
You might not have known what happened in the East Coast games until, and the kids are just so thirsty. A certain kind of kid, at least, is just so thirsty for data that, you know, you would just enjoy looking at stock numbers and I would enjoy looking at baseball box scores.
What age were you when you started doing the crossword?
I feel like me and my dad did the jumble every night when I was like 6 years old.
Uh-huh.
But there was also, there was the crossword and the bridge column. And for some reason, the Seattle Times had that weird word search where you were not allowed to circle the words, but you had to put an individual circle around each letter.
Yeah. That we had that in Anchorage.
We never, I never did that.
Did you read the bridge column?
No, it was mysterious.
I tried to read it assuming that if I read the bridge column every day, that I would learn bridge.
And
I never understood a word of it. But I continued to read it. It was just like, you know, Margie trumps her across the hearts and, you know, and does a trick of, and I was just like, what?
We need to do newspaper bridge columns at some point because it's the kind of thing where there was never a critical mass of people wanting that. Chess was always more popular than bridge, but there was never a chess column. Some historical accident put contract bridge in the newspaper next to the comics
for decades
and no one ever wanted it or explained why, and it's time to bring those people to justice.
I swear to you, I read it every day. I'm just thinking about all the lost time.
Do you know what I really enjoy, John?
What do you enjoy, Ken?
I enjoy these addenda entries we've been recording.
Yeah, we just got done. Omnibus. We just got done doing an addenda, and it really they really stand on their own.
It's fun because we have managed to create this group of thousands of people who just do the work for us.
Mm-hmm. They all have things they want to add to our shows.
They all have fun, interesting expertise and stories, and they, you know, you want to talk back to the podcast, right. And of course you can, or you'll look like an idiot on the train. But now they can. They're suggesting their own material, and in the addenda episode we can share those to an audience in this time period and beyond.
Sometimes we argue with them, but most of the time their additions are relevant and quite interesting.
And we're certainly respectful.
That's right. Well, yeah, mostly.
Mostly.
But they lead us to sometimes go off on a different aspect of an episode we've done.
Yeah, they're kind of freewheeling in a way that, you know, with Omnibus, we're usually trying to get back to the story because we're trying to, you know, finish educating the future on whatever happened to this French foreign minister or whatever.
Right.
And here, we can just say whatever and we can just start randomly Googling facts. You wanted to know how long a $5 bill lasted. So we looked it up.
5 years.
4.9 years or something.
But these are available only to people who subscribe to our Patreon, which involves some sort of contribution to the production of the show.
Yes, we have multiple tiers, and at any tier from $5 up, which would be all the tiers, you get immediate access at the end of every month to a new addenda episode, some of which are like getting up to an hour in length.
That's right.
How long was that last one? Was it close to an hour?
Yeah, it was 50 minutes, I think, worth of us going from episode to episode and kind of dealing with our viewer mail.
So a whole new, really a regular-sized bonus omnibus entry every month if you have the resources and choose to support the show.
And at different tiers of our Patreon, you have other benefits, right? Name some benefits at different tiers.
At the $10 tier, you get access to our, as well as the addenda episode, you get access to our image feed where we post show notes, funny things people have sent us, you and I clowning around.
Our show notes are hilarious.
They're illegible.
Right.
But let's not downplay how good they are since we do want people to donate.
But there are tons of goofs. You know, right now I'm sitting here with the Jeopardy trophy, greatest of all time. It's sitting for some reason over here on my side of the desk.
For some reason.
And on top of it, it has a little statue of a Basque or Catalonian boy taking a poop. Now, you're not going to know what that symbolizes, what that comes from, unless you're a subscriber. And this is a photograph that we'll post on our image.
At the $20 tier, you get a signed copy of one of our show notes. I have brought a Sharpie, and I'm going to make you sign those today.
Oh, we're going to send them to people in the mail.
Yes, we are sending them out worldwide.
Wow, how exciting.
For them.
Yeah.
Well, and for you, if you like signing things.
I like signing things.
For $50. These high tiers are very aspirational.
Sure, they're specific to people that have a little bit more money to share.
Well, and they're specific to people who, like, you know, could just as easily hear the show for free, but enjoy the feeling of support and community, yeah, I guess.
Right.
At the $50 level, you get to choose a show topic that goes to the top of our heap. And we just got our first request today from Krista, who has two ideas that she'd like us to do.
I'm excited to hear them.
And at the $100 level, John and I will actually come to your house and do some chores.
Yeah, that's right. I will be a human Roomba.
We will
put me in a closet, and
we will actually do a video chat.
Yeah,
at the $100 level,
that's a lot of money, though.
It really, on no level is that worth it. Again, it's just about the feeling of of support and community that people feel.
A video chat with somebody? It's probably going to be MC Hammer's kids or somebody that we're going to talk to.
Where would they get the money?
MC Hammer burn.
Because the newspaper was such a family event, the comics were huge.
Yeah.
And even more so in the early 20th century when newspapers were big and there were lavishly printed color adventures. And so on Sunday morning, you would spread it out on the floor and you would want to know what happened to Buck Rogers next, or Prince Valiant, or Little Nemo, or whoever. And it was really the equivalent of Technicolor movies, widescreen movies, before, you know, decades before that was a thing.
Do you remember when the comics page expanded to two pages?
I feel like my whole life is just comics contraction, getting smaller and smaller as the paper shrunk.
When I was little, the comics page was a page. And then during the big boom of comics, like newspaper comics in the 80s, mm-hmm. when it seemed like it had become a thing that, like, a regular
it was Jim
funny
Davis.
People.
It was Jim Davis making
Garfield.
$100 million in Garfield, and suddenly
he had Well, and Doonesbury had such a profound effect on the culture at large, or at least, you know, like counterculture.
I feel like every paper I read had Doonesbury actually on the op-ed page.
So that happened at it, and that might be an entry in the omnibus. When Doonesbury went to the op-ed page, I think that was also an 80s thing, although
Bloom County got to stay.
Yeah.
Because it had silliness in with its Caspar Weinberger jokes.
And Bloom County was, you know, just like a pretty cheap Doonesbury ripoff.
Yep.
But I think it was during the Reagan administration that Doonesbury, you know, got so focused on the Reagan administration that people complained.
Well, it was also increasingly out of touch with the times. It's kind of a relic of late 60s college life.
Right.
And suddenly it's Morning in America and nobody wants that next to Croc and Hagar the Horrible.
Right. Like Zonker became hard to explain. In 1975, Zonker was somebody that everybody had a brother that was Zonker.
I think Mike Doonesbury became a yuppie. Like, he really did 80s-fi the strip.
He had an Asian wife, Mike Doonesbury.
As was the style at the time.
That's right.
So the comics page was, and we think of that as the boom in our lifetime, but there was a bigger boom in the early 20th century when, you know, people would read, where cartoonists were public intellectuals and public entertainers and public successes, glowing articles written about how now that Steve Canyon is in this many papers, this cartoonist is now making $10,000 a week. Like, they were making just insane amounts of mid-century money by drawing, because, you know, they had the syndicates had the newspapers by the short hairs. Like, people needed to know what was going to happen to Steve Canyon.
Is this pre or post Charles Schulz?
A lot of this is pre. You know, Peanuts starts in the mid-50s, or early to mid-50s.
And this is 30s?
Yeah, and that kind of reshapes the comics page around funny, simply drawn stuff that can get shrunk down as paper costs go up. But before then, it was a lot of kind of lavishly drawn. And it was your daily check-in. It was your equivalent of your TV show in the pre-television era.
Right, Phantom.
You would want to know what Mandrake and the Phantom were doing.
I loved the Phantom.
That stuff persisted into my life there was a Saturday morning show, I guess, just because the comic syndicate still had so much leftover muscle.
But the Phantom was a serial that was fun or was exciting because the Phantom did, he was genuinely in adventures and not just a, like dabbing a wet hanky.
I want to do the Phantom in the Omnibus at some point because it's extremely popular in some part of Southeast Asia.
Huh.
There's some New Guinea or something is fascinated with the Phantom. And I don't know why this is, but I want to get to the bottom of it. But none of these names were bigger than Al Capp, who, you know, based on some experiences in his youth, hitchhiking around the American South
and Appalachia,
created...
Or Appalachia. Didn't we get an angry letter?
People get mad at us when we say Appalachia the way you say, if you can read. Based on his experiences, he created a strip called Lil Abner about a kind of a dim-witted country boy in his tiny backwoods, you know, a hillbilly community called Dog Patch. And it started out as just kind of a novelty. And I believe this predates what we've entered into the Omnibus before, is the fascination with hillbilly culture in the 50s on American television, you know, the Beverly Hillbillies and so forth. I think without Lil Abner, you might not get any of that. Because this was a novelty for people to see these rough-hewn yokels and their bizarre backwoods ways. And
is this, I mean, I'm wondering whether there's a component of that that became kind of a fascination because of the, you know, the Works Progress Administration era of Tennessee Valley Authority and also the capturing of some of that hillbilly music on, you know, by
early Wax Cylinders and Alan Lomax and
the Lomax music, and then that translating into that mid-century country and western music, which evolved out of some of that work.
Also, it would not really have been possible, even maybe 50 years earlier, to captivate America with this novel look at people living in little wooden houses, because that was everybody's life.
Right.
It was only once, like, cities became the center of American discourse that it was possible to be like, can you imagine? They're all farmers in the mountains.
Right.
I bet they have funny ways.
Yeah, feuds even.
They do. So the strip started out as kind of a simplistic thing about Lil Abner and his colorful friends and Daisy Mae Scruggs, the beautiful young, you know, kind of the prototype for a Daisy Duke type. Cap often said he invented the miniskirt, who's always chasing Abner.
Yeah, Daisy was always improbably pretty given what everyone else on the strip looked like.
Everyone else is realistically inbred.
Yeah.
And that's a trope that persisted to this day insofar as we still have hillbilly art, that the men are big galoots, but there's always just some, you know, knockout woman in her simple country. Whereas I'm sure that honestly, that's probably a fantasy that goes back to feudalism. You know, the pretty village girl that you can ride in on your steed in and
impress,
do what you will.
Her last name really was Yoakum. Daisy Mae Yoakum was who she married, right?
She married Abner Yoakum.
Right. Her initial last name was Scrag,
which I think was Yokel plus Hokum.
Right.
But then Dwight Yoakum actually exists now. It's like country fried cartoon characters are merging into real life and nobody noticed.
Huh.
That's crazy.
That is crazy.
Maybe Dwight Yoakum was actually named like Dwight
Penobscot.
Yeah. Slipovitz. And changed his name.
Yeah, her like Mammy's original name was Pansy Hunks. I had no idea.
Pansy Hunks. I have no memories of reading Lil Abner. He wrapped it up in the mid-70s, and I believe it was rare in that it's not a strip that continued under different hands.
I do remember it from the newspaper, and it was always kind of unintelligible to me. I didn't understand you know, 1975, I was seven. I was deep in the comics page, but I think Lil Abner was sort of trailing off by that point, just sort of regurgitating a lot of the sort of tropes
Those strips accumulate just decades of tropes, and as we'll see, their own language that shapes the culture. But as a 7-year-old in the early 70s, you're not gonna.
It was like Snuffy Smith, you know. There were these comics where you're just like, I'm not sure what's going on or
Why it's like the bridge column. Why does this exist? Yeah, and why does it exist every day? It has its own square footage. It has a place in the world. And yet, why?
I never laughed. I never cried.
I
never skipped it.
Exactly. You still have to read them.
Yeah.
That's a funny thing about kids reading these paperbacks. And this still happens, even though the comic page is gone. Kids, your daughter went through a Garfield phase.
She's in it still.
My kids had Calvin and Hobbes and Farside and Peanuts phases where you will just read these dog-eared paperbacks over and over, either actually laughing or starting out with, ha, this must be a joke, and then kind of learning to laugh at them.
Yeah.
It's where kids learn about humor.
It is.
For generations.
My daughter will still sidle up to me out of nowhere and say, want to hear a Garfield joke? And then she
and
does.
Do you?
Yeah. And I always say yes. And she does the thing where she recounts a comic strip. So Garfield's sitting on a table. John walks
luckily
in.
Luckily, there's not a lot of stage directions in Garfield.
Yeah.
It's not a broad canvas.
John walks in and he's carrying a turkey. And, you know, and she sets it up and then delivers the punch.
I think we may have said this on the show before, but I can still see them in my head decades later. You can remember every word of the strip somehow. Like, it really takes on a life in your head. Something about the juxtaposition of the panels really comes to life in a kid's head in a weird way. So Al Cap strip, which started out as kind of regular hillbilly satire, regular hillbilly slice of life, becomes actual satire with takes on the affairs of the day and characters that become coded for different societal forces. And it's really what gives us Pogo, which keeps the rural setting, and then eventually Doonesbury. Like, I think without Al Cap, he's really the first cartoonist to grapple with the headlines, essentially, ripped from the headlines. You know, if once Sinatra becomes a popular crooner, there's a Sinatra character called Hal Fashionata in the strip, coming to Dogpatch and wooing all the women. And Sinatra loved it. And once Liberace is popular, there's kind of a flamboyant guy, a pianist named Lover Boynick. And Liberace was not into this.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He didn't like being satirized? Did it look like Liberace?
Yeah, it's clearly Liberace, and I wonder if you're a closeted Liberace in the 50s, if you don't like exaggerated versions of yourself, because at some point somebody's going to say, wait a second.
But he's Lover Boynick.
Lover Boynick.
Lover Boynick, so he's yes. being depicted as a heterosexual.
Well, there's a weird thing where, I don't know if I'm going to say this in a way that makes sense or will get us angry letters, but there's a weird thing where the mid-century idea of the sissy somehow coalesces both what we would call today a nice, shy gay boy. You know, he's a sissy because he doesn't want to fight or do sports.
Right.
But and the sissy who's kind of a moony, love-struck kid that's always picking posies for his girl.
Right.
like the sissy is both extremely gay and extremely straight. And I don't it's like no one was familiar enough with homosexuality to actually put their finger on that pulse and say, well, this doesn't make sense at all.
But you know, but straight and yet always vulnerable to the muscle man kicking sand in his face. Like there was not yet the option of being a goth, right? But you could be a poet.
Yes.
You could be a sort of, not an Oscar Wilde, but a romantic.
Yes, and you're always carrying a heart-shaped box of candy for your girl, and you've written sheaves of love notes to her.
Right.
And, you know, this was something that faded away as we wised up to how that didn't make sense. But honestly, I still see it today online, you know, kind of these alpha MRA types, not MRI types, although I would like to see an MRI. you know, they put up pictures of Prince Harry, for example, going from, to them, a strong beret-wearing British fighting man into this cuck who gets led around by his American wife. And she's not white, which is, I'm sure, a big part of their psychosis around this.
Right.
But really, the implication is, look how gay this guy got by marrying a beautiful TV star. Fellas, is it gay to marry a beautiful woman?
I mean, I remember wanting much more to be Byron than to be a sports hero.
You were a poet kid.
Yeah, but I didn't want to get.
And shocker, you became a sensitive indie rocker.
Can you imagine?
I don't believe it.
But I'm also big, and I say strong.
Were you getting recruited for all these teams and you were like, no way, coach, I just love Keats.
Definitely got, you know, the Army recruiters really liked me. But
that makes football look safe, so keep that in mind.
When I looked back, when I would get to the end of a comic book and there would be that George Atlas ad in the back where the skinny kid got sand kicked in his face. I had a very strong reaction to that. And it was twofold. One was I was chubby, so I wished I was skinny. I couldn't imagine somebody being sad they were skinny because right. I had internalized that I was husky.
Oh, it does a number on kids just to hear once that they're chubby. And then it just changes their self-image.
Then it's just like, well, how could you be mad that you were skinny? And I still, you know, when people complain about like, oh, I'm so skinny, I can't put on any weight. I'm always like,
you know, in our time, it's okay to just punch that person.
Yeah, that's true. But the other thing was I was terrified of having sand kicked in my face.
Like literally, you thought that might... The Charles Atlas ad had convinced you this was a real thing that might happen?
Yeah, that I would be...
In Alaska?
That I would be... Well, not... It'd be snow. It'd be snow. And I did get snow kicked in my face. You know, one of the dangers of being a kid in Alaska is that you're going to get whitewashed. And whitewashing was when a bunch of boys tackled you in the snow and they stuffed snow down the front of your shirt and down the front of your pants. Oh, and they would like push your face in the snow and whitewash you. And I got whitewashed a lot until I had my growth spurt. Right, ninth grade, eighth grade, seventh grade, I was smaller than other kids, and I just got punished. And then I think in 11th grade, I went from 5'6 to 6 feet tall.
You went from zero to hero.
Yeah, it did.
You got from goofus to gallant.
Like in 6 months, you know, just like my bones were just like... And then I stopped getting whitewashed. And I think for the first...
For the first year, you whitewashed other smaller boys relentlessly.
No, I didn't understand that I had grown. Oh. You know, in my head, I was still small.
Right. We always think we're the same.
And I didn't understand why I wasn't getting picked on anymore.
So Al Cap became really funny, not just a cartoon figure, but by consensus, even among public intellectuals, the greatest satirist of his day.
And now it was...
Steinbeck loved him. Marshall McLuhan loved him. Eventually Updike loves him. Everybody just agrees that this guy is doing fantastic work.
And was he a New York Jewish guy?
A poor Jewish kid from New Haven, Connecticut. So, you know, in the sticks in the tri-state area. But,
right.
But
proximate to Yale.
But definitely one of these kids who became a kind of a starving artist, you know, found he had a knack. Realized art school might not pay, and then suddenly read in the papers that whoever Hal Foster is making $3,000 a week drawing Prince Valiant, and it changes his life.
Right. He's living in an artist garret in Hell's Kitchen that now is a $7,000 a month studio apartment.
So he wasn't actually a hillbilly in any way, but, you know, by introducing the tropes of American culture of the day into the strip, he became a celebrity. He had, in addition to his having the most popular comic strip in America, he had a newspaper column. He had a radio show every week on 500 stations. He was the only mid-20th century cartoonist who was just on TV all the time.
Wow.
He had like 5 different talk shows over the course of his life, like he's Mike Douglas or something.
What, really?
And he was always on The Tonight Show. He was one of these kind of permanent guests, like the way, what's her name for the zoo? The zookeeper guy, yeah. And Joan, all these people who you'd never heard of except that they were on with Johnny every 3 weeks. That was Al Cap, and Lil Abner stayed a hit. It was a pretty big Broadway show in the 50s, and eventually a movie. Considering how much it's gone down the memory hole, I assume because that kind of, first of all, it was very topical, and also that kind of look at rural America is no longer fashionable.
Right.
It's weird to imagine that it was one of the biggest pop culture properties of the time. Everybody knew Al Cap.
Basically, Beverly Hillbillies was an Al Cap. He invented the genre.
Yeah, the riff of the... And if you watch Hee Haw and you see the cute girls in their scanty overalls, and this all comes straight from tropes in his strip. The funny thing is his politics did change over this period as he's satirizing America in the strip. He's getting older. And of course, like you with your eye watching, he doesn't realize he's changed.
Sure.
He thinks of himself as consistent. He's always thought that he roots for the underdog. And part of that, a lot of it just dates back to being a kid. He was run over by a trolley. We've talked about trolley accidents, mm-hmm. I think. Maybe I mentioned him. He was run over by a trolley and lost a leg as a child.
He was one-legged through all this?
He was America's best one-legged cartoonist.
Wow.
So he had a prosthetic and a limp, and it really colored his, you know, imagine that happening to you at that age where you're so conscious of differences. And it made him root for the underdog. So he was a New Deal Democrat, loved FDR, and early Al Caps are always full of really scathing portrayals of the military-industrial complex, you know, a General Bull Moose and Jay Roringham Fatback, all these kind of tycoons that the government is always throwing pork at. Awful, awful fat cats. But by the 60s, he's gotten a little older, and he thinks now rooting for the underdog means that these grubby hippies have taken over, and he needs to stand up for middle-aged white men and the police and the U.S. Department of Defense.
Sure,
and
mailmen.
Supporters of the Vietnam War. Like, on every position, he sees himself as being internally consistent.
Sure.
But really, he has turned his gimlet eye on youth culture.
My dad was a socialist in the 30s and 40s and 50s, like a radical, and yet was on the wrong side of the Vietnam War for a long time.
He fought with the Viet Cong.
No. He was, you know, a World War II veteran, so it had never occurred to him that the U.S. military wasn't an agent of justice and truth.
We're fighting in Asian jungles just like then, and it's gonna liberate these people.
And I think it was 1969 or something before, and it was my mom that finally convinced my dad to turn on Vietnam.
Cap never came around. I think he lived near. He lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He lived, you know, born in New Haven, ended up near Cambridge. So he was always near college culture and hated it. He would go from, you know, he would speak on campuses and he would start getting protested and he would thrive on it. He would put out books and albums where grubby hippies are yelling at him on the cover. He got sued in the 60s for putting Joan Baez in his strip as Joni Phony.
Whoa.
A limousine liberal who pretends to be down with the underclass, but is actually a huge fake. And Joan Baez sued him.
What?
And
for slander?
Yeah, it went to court for defamation. And a judge said, no, you know, satire. You know, there were still a lot of important test cases about satire that had yet to be worked out.
Right.
And so, you know, Al Cap being told it's okay to call Joan Baez Joni Phony in the paper, we understand that as a given, but it went to court.
And this was a cultural divide that ended up being adjudicated just in the court of public opinion. As the boomers got older, they just sort of took over critical mass. But I remember...
Right, all the... Yeah.
I mean, I remember Joan Fonda with her hand up in the air and just... and the adults around me going, there's a line, and that crosses it.
He probably his most famous moment of his grumpy old man period. Have you ever seen the John Lennon movie Imagine?
No. Is this where he's playing a white piano and the windows are all open?
That's in the video.
That's the video.
Is that in the movie? It might be from the movie. One of the scenes is a bed-in that John and Yoko do in Montreal.
I've seen all that footage.
They're just, of course, everybody's seen this, and they're gonna stay in bed and let reporters come in until the war in Vietnam ends. And one of the reporters that gets shown in is Al Cap, who just wants to yell at him.
Really?
So there's a very testy exchange in the movie where he's just being like, oh yeah, nice job being naked on the cover, you guys. Everyone really wanted to see your pubic here. Hey, Yoko, how do you put up with this loser? Until finally, like, Derek Taylor tries to kick him out of the room. And John's like, no, let him stay. You know, but Lennon gets more and more pissed off at this sideburned American cartoonist.
Right.
Just getting in his face and
50-year-old
and feeling
guy.
Like he's representing American values against this new onslaught. And he still thinks of himself as a good liberal, even as he hates Ted Kennedy and Spiro Agnew's trying to recruit him to run for the Senate. And he's giving, you know, $500 luncheons for Jack Kemp. So he becomes as a public figure, he becomes, you know, a very public conservative and increasingly kind of out of step with what you'd expect of the greatest satirist of his era.
I guess we think of that era where the Democratic Party or the left is still dominated by organized labor. Mm-hmm. And organized labor also became more and more conservative as the years went on. So,
I mean, you're right. Organized labor is the factor that keeps a lot of these, it's not just the South, that's a factor that keeps a lot of these kind of working class conservative guys in the Democratic Party and allows for the Republicans to have their own kind of Rockefeller types, where the two parties were much less ideological and more tribal without ideology, I guess.
Yeah, it's strange to think that now organized labor, we think of it as breaking right, even though the whole principle of organizing labor is leftist.
Well, I mean, way worse than, you know, it was, it was beyond the pale when it was first suggested.
It involved a lot of like bomb throwing and strike breaking.
We should note in the era of Me Too, we should note that Al Capp also had his issues with this. You know, on many college campuses, he was apparently...
Was he a groper?
Groping and propositioning women.
Yeah.
And one of these went to court, I think in, I don't know where, Wisconsin maybe. And after his time, many of the beautiful young women that he came up against as a celebrity revealed that he had really come up against them. And both Grace Kelly and Goldie Hawn said he had exposed himself to them.
Really?
Yeah. So, which kind of plays into...
A fraudager.
Yes, a fraudageur. And they were not fraudagesses. It kind of plays into the gender politics of what we're about to learn about Sadie Hawkins. Because the Little Abner Strip had a ton of cultural legacies that mean nothing to us today, but anybody 10 years older than us would immediately know that Fearless Fosdick, if you say Fearless Fosdick or Joe, they would know, oh, one is the Dick Tracy knockoff in Little Abner, and one is the character that always has the rain cloud over his head.
So I know Fearless Fosdick because he was further satirized in the fabulous Furry Freak Brothers,
right,
which was the counterculture comic that I found, you know, buried in my older brother's effects.
Comics with an X.
And
that has drug slang and nudity.
Right. So it was referencing they were referencing Fearless Fosdick.
And it's a clear Dick Tracy character. Looks almost exactly like him, but it was so well known that you could parody Fearless Fosdick instead of Dick Tracy.
Right, right.
And some of the things he mentioned we still have with us today. Double whammy, apparently, is a usage that comes from Lil Abner.
Oh.
It really just shows how pervasive the comics page was that, you know, we still have so much American language that came out of, you know, to call somebody a milquetoast comes from a comics page.
Really?
Words like Jeep, even Zap comes from Buck Rogers.
Right.
Lower Slobovia, which we still kind of use for...
I say that all the time.
What do you use it for? Like a place that's hard, that's far away in Seattle, or like a benighted part of the world? Or?
I always say that I'm from Lower Slobovia. It's my, it's like a, whatever, a natural sort of description of like, how I live in Slobovia.
But for you, it's like a psychic Slobovia. You're in a Slobovia of the mind, or?
Yeah. Well, you know, the root cause being slob.
Oh, I see.
So, Slobovia. And I think that actually, it's a reference. Lower Slobovia or Slobovia is referenced in the movie Making the Grade, which was a 1984 Judd Nelson vehicle that I saw in theaters, and this is Judd Nelson pre-Breakfast Club.
We have talked about Making the Grade before, I think.
Have we?
I think this movie kind of looms large in your youth.
It does. It was first of all, the movie that introduced Andrew Dice Clay.
Mm.
He had not existed prior to this in the culture.
We hadn't been introduced. We just thought nursery rhymes were like, he stuck in his thumb and pulled out a plum.
Right. We didn't realize it could be nasty.
We were like, well, we didn't know what could happen in that pie.
And Andrew Dice Clay plays his Andrew Dice Clay character fully formed in this movie. I think it was, he was already doing this as a comedy routine and got cast. His character name is Dice. But it's a classic movie where Judd... It's
not a classic movie.
Making the plot is that there's a preppy guy who needs to graduate from college, otherwise his dad is going to disown him. But he's like a playboy, and he doesn't want to do any work. So he hires Judd Nelson, who's a kid from the streets, to masquerade as him at the college and do his work. And when he graduates, he's going to give him $10,000 or something. And then the preppy kid...
What an unlikely setup.
I know.
What a ripe comic scenario.
And so Judd Nelson, this guy from, you know, the inner city, is at this rich preppy school, and it's a culture clash. But at one point, the preppy kid is just hanging out in the dorm, And the proctor or the principal comes in and says, have I seen you before? Are you a student here? And he says, I'm an exchange student from Slobovia. And in 1984, I thought that was hilarious and jumped for joy.
I think in Lil Abner, Lower Slobovia starts out in the 40s and 50s as kind of a European backwater, maybe kind of behind the Iron Curtain, vaguely Slavic.
Right, probably Baltic.
Right. Yeah, maybe.
Or Balkan.
Yes, ball something. Yes. One of the two balls of Europe.
Let's say Balkan.
I like how Europe has two balls.
Yeah, that does.
And then there's
but they're widely separated.
And then there's a continent, like a shaft-like continent, extending westward from them. He also gave us the schmooze. Oh, if you can imagine those kind of white whiskered,
the schmoo,
bowling pin-like blobs that lived in a nearby valley. It was a very fanciful strip.
I'm so embarrassed at being so connected to this strip and not really realizing it, because I had a schmoo.
The schmoo,
I had a stuffed
on
schmoo.
I feel like they put the schmoo on Saturday morning with the Flintstones or, yeah, Jetsons or something.
I mean, people listening to this show are like, these boomers are so old.
Okay,
but
boomer.
I was not a boomer. I was a child, but I had a schmoo and I didn't even understand what a schmoo was.
Of all these gifts Lil Abner gave to the popular culture just by virtue of persistence, of being in everybody's eyeball once a day for almost 50 years, none is more powerful than the one that began early in the strip, mid-November 1937. Cap starts teasing Sadie Hawkins Day, a dog patch ceremony that really Lil Abner is scared of little, but Sadie Hawkins Day puts the fear of God into him.
Hmm.
And we learn that it's a venerable town tradition. When Dog Patch was first founded, one of its early residents was a guy named Hezekiah Hawkins,
mm-hmm,
who had a daughter named Sadie, the homeliest gal in all the our hills.
The Big Ethel of Dog Patch.
Exactly. This was, a funny stereotype at the time that you see it in Tex Avery cartoons,
yeah,
Basil Wolverton work. You know, our poor protagonist thinks the woman is going to be conventionally attractive, but then she has a weird nose and teeth at all angles. Ha 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 ha.
Well, it's in Snow White.
Yeah, that's
right?
True. That's true. Turning into a crone. So Hezekiah Hawkins, her poor pappy, does not know what he's going to do. And so he calls together every bachelor in Dog Patch and says, this is Sadie Hawkins Day. He's going to fire his gun. Then the boys start running. And then he's going to fire again. And Sadie.
And the British kept it coming.
There wasn't quite as many as there was a while ago. And then Sadie starts a running. And the one she catches will be her husband.
Ah.
Now, it's not clear how he's enforcing this.
Right.
I mean, he does have a gun in this scenario, but presumably in Dog Patch, everyone has a gun. Like, how is he making every man in town run? And then it's a reverse of the Atalanta myth, whereby everyone wants this desirable princess and only the fastest runner can get her. In this case, it's a funny topsy-turvy version where the men are running away,
right,
from the undesirable
man. And the least desirable man, the least capable person, the slowest,
exactly,
is the one that...
Survival of the unfittest. And I don't know, how does he get the boys to do this? Does he have blackmail material in all of them? Are these all the single closeted gay boys of Dog Patch?
You know, the thing is, we live in a time of total individuality where it's just assumed that every person has free will and will decide for themselves what they're going to do. But I think even as recently as the mid-20th century, there was still a kind of...
You would just do what your pappy said.
Yeah, there was a kind of collective understanding that if an authority figure said, all the boys line up, the boys lined up. And there wasn't even the most nonconformist boy was like, I guess I got to line up. But no one would have dared stand up against the town and say, I mean, here I am. Analyzing a comic strip, who knows, who cares, but I can picture a scene where all the men in town would just acquiesce to this plan, and you know, and they would say, like, I'm fast, I'm gonna get a, I won't get steamrolled into this marriage.
The longevity of all these comic strips meant that many of them had yearly traditions. You know, every Christmas Walt Kelly would do a different riff on what, God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, or some Christmas song with funny lyrics. Deck the Halls. And in this case, every November, this was a big hit with readers, and every November, Cap brought back Sadie Hawkins Day. And of course, and in the town, the tradition was that was the day that the women could chase the men. And this was the day that Abner always had to avoid Daisy May.
Why would you want to avoid Daisy May?
What's wrong with Abner?
I don't know.
What's his deal?
He's a dummy, is what?
He's an incel. Yeah. No, wait, he's a volcel.
I don't know. He's a ball cell.
Maybe he's asexual. That's nothing wrong with that. But for whatever reason, Abner is not interested in Daisy May, although they do eventually get married in the 50s. But after decades of him avoiding her every November in Sadie Hawkins Day, and eventually it comes that there's a dance before the race that the women take advantage of while they're dancing with their bow with an X, they're wearing big hobnailed boots so they can stamp on their feet. And that means the following day in the race, the men are much slower because they've had their feet stomped.
But they're just generally slower. So there's no evidence that any one particular girl is going to catch the man with the broken feet first.
It's true. How does this work out when there's an equal number of
You could stomp your beau's feet, and then the girl standing next to you gets him
first.
He'll
get caught by somebody else. They haven't thought this through at all.
No.
I mean, they're not the brightest. They still live in Dogpatch.
True.
They're smarter than the Slobovians, I guess. This became a huge trend in real life within just a year or two of it first appearing in the paper. This becomes, you know, campus's love of a good fad.
Right.
And this becomes an American college campus fad. Every university has Sadie Hawkins Day every year, and they do it in synchronization with the comic strip.
Really?
Yes. So every July, student organizing committees start reaching out to Al Capp, asking them, hey, when are the Sadie Hawkins strips going to run this year?
Right.
Because, you know, we've got to plan this thing Florida A&M or
right.
Texas Wesleyan
taking a break from swallowing raccoons or whatever the latest fad is.
And this becomes a huge, just a beloved tradition on college campuses. And I guess it speaks to a few things. I mean, for one, during the Depression, this was a dance that was not semi-formal. You could wear kind of funny country gear because it would be Lil Abner themed.
Mm-hmm.
So you could wear crappy clothes to the dance. So it's an affordable Depression era date. It also speaks to the fact that the jazz age is gone. You know, the assertive flapper trope flowered briefly and was gone. And now women are back in the boat where they've been for decades with very little control over their own destiny and choices.
But this doesn't seem like a feminist event. It seems like one where women are opening themselves up to being mocked, right? I mean, if you do collect your man, the whole premise is that
you couldn't get a man otherwise,
right? That you're a big Ethel, unless it's a boyfriend girlfriend thing where they look at each other, you know, they wink across the room like you're going to catch me type of thing, where it's a kind of flirty.
Well, there's no actual race.
Right, but I mean, my
the athletic
recollection
side of it ends, and it really is just who's going to ask whom to the dance.
I remember leading up to the Sadie Hawkins dance that I had someone I hoped would ask me, and there was someone I hoped wouldn't ask me, and then when I realized no one was going to ask me, it was double triple devastating. It was definitely the message was.
Well, so you finally know what it feels like to be a woman in literally any era of history.
I know what it feels like to be a woman every morning.
I was just watching the new Greta Gerwig Little Women movie, which is a little revisionist, and it really makes a meal out of the fact, like almost the existential horror of being a woman in the 19th century and just knowing that no matter what your aptitudes or dreams or self-image is, that you have almost no power to make that happen. Things are just going to happen to you.
Soft power, but that may be, eliminating the soft power element may be part of the revisionism.
But the movie really plays up how marriage is the only option. But, you know, as the Sadie Hawkins trend points out, even in that arena, women only had kind of the softest kind of power to be flirty at a ball or whatever.
Right.
And not too flirty, or then you're one of those girls.
Well, they had the power not to ask anybody to stay home from the dance.
So I guess what got borrowed from the strip was not so much the idea that these are the homely gals, although the event persisted for decades named after this ugly, right, famously ugly Dogpatchian woman.
I mean, you see it in the movie Groundhog Day. It's the climax of the film. Right, the auction, the male auction,
right,
where Chris Elliott gets up there and is only bid $5, but then our hero.
And the only reason that's funny is because it's a turnabout on the trope we've seen for years,
right,
of women getting
auctioned off,
auctioned off essentially and objectified that way. Here in the Northwest, there are Sadie Hawkins events. but they are not called Sadie Hawkins Day or Sadie Hawkins Dances.
Is it the clam dance? What's the famous clam dance?
From Ivers commercials?
Yeah, the Ivers, or is it the...
Yes, women dress in a giant razor clam costume.
It's the Rainier beer chase where
it's,
they
it's
dress
the artesians.
In... Yeah, they dress in beer bottles.
No, here, I believe this all dates back to a University of Washington group of girls, the Mortar Board, some kind of academic society for girls.
I remember that.
That also called themselves the Tolo Club. Do you know the word Tolo?
No.
Apparently a Chinook jargon word for beating or winning or success or something.
Tolo.
So this was the Tolo Club, the success club. And when these kind of bright young...
This is not uncommon. There's a Tai Club too.
What is
at
Tai
the university? It's also a Chinook jargon word.
Is that the boys' version of the Tolo Club?
Let's see. Tai is a word that means chief or boss, big boss man. And the Tai Club is a club in BC that's like, you know, it's like a fraternal organization.
It's like service. It's their Kiwanis or Elks or whatever.
Yeah.
At the UW, the Tolo Club was, I think it's just some kind of academic club for some kind of, you know, sororal-like organization for women. And they held an annual dance where they borrowed the Sadie Hawkins tradition. This is the time when the girls ask the boys, tee-hee-hee.
Tee-hee-hee.
And everybody's got a little interest there because, as we've mentioned, men secretly just want to be asked out and hate this double standard as much as women.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but the University of Washington yearbook is called the Tai.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Chinook jargon. Still
jargon.
Caught in your back teeth.
It sure is.
Decades after you ate it.
So what is the Sadie Hawkins dance called?
It's now called the Tolo.
The Tolo.
Have you never heard this?
No. Is it still an active event?
Yeah. So any Seattle public high school that has one of these dances will call it Tolo. And so you'll hear these kids in the hall unaware that this has a real name, Sadie Hawkins. Hey, is anybody going to ask you to Tolo? Like, are you going to go to Tolo? Should we go to Tolo if Julie doesn't ask you?
I never heard this. This is not a thing that happened in Anchorage.
This is the only Chinook jargon word that I knew, aside from Hayu Muckamuck.
And you knew this because your kids are in Seattle Public Schools?
Yes, my kids are now Tolo adjacent.
Have they gone to a Tolo?
I believe my son has been to Tolo.
Wow.
But I was just making fun of him. And now, thanks to you, I know that there's a long cultural tradition, and I was very, very insensitive, actually, for making fun of Tolo. It's good. It's a good name. It's better than Sadie Hawkins Day because it doesn't...
Right. It connects us to our regional past rather than to Little Abner.
Rather than some Beatle-hating cartoonist.
And that concludes Sadie Hawkins Day, entry 1094.GN3912. Certificate number 44390 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts are archived at Omnibus Project. At Omnibus Project. Our handles, of course, were our names, Ken Jennings and John Roderick. You may have heard of Ken Jennings. He's America's most famous boy genius.
But the girls never asked me to Tolo.
You may not have heard of me, but I'm America's second boy genius. Neither a boy nor a genius.
Aging boy genii.
I'm on Instagram. If you want to know more, if you want to ask me out, slide into my DMs. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can go to Reddit or Facebook or, I guess, nowhere else because we don't have a Snapchat. I'm not even sure if you can have a Snapchat anymore.
We don't have a TikTok.
We don't have a Kick. But we do have fan groups on Facebook and Reddit, which I guess comprise the Democratic and Republican parties of the internet. I'm not sure which is which, though.
They are called Futurelings.
Futurelings. Both of them.
Both groups.
You can mail us actual things at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. If you inherited some stamps from your grandmother and also inherited some old Ray-Bans from your grandfather, you could put them in a box and send them to us.
If your grandparents died leaving yellowed mid-century newspaper strips on their fridge, we want all of those
strips.
Send them. What were Frank and Ernest up to on November 17th, 1977. We want to know.
And if you are so inclined, we appreciate your generous support at our Patreon account, patreon.com/omnibusproject. And we do have quite a exciting bit of bonus content for our Patreon subscribers.
Especially if you give now, and now there's months of bonus content there. If you joined right now, there's probably 4 or 5 bonus episodes you could listen to immediately.
Bonus episodes where we really get candid and talk about our actual selves, not like these omnibus episodes where we stick strictly to the facts.
This is John's true Byronic self comes out, and it's a lot of his yearning, and yeah. He reads his poetry.
I do. I'm very sad there.
He serenades a girl on the internet that had just made him sad.
But beautifully sad.
Yes.
That is patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization will survive. You have a unique piece of knowledge that we don't, the date of our collective death. Now, we hope and pray that catastrophe may never come, but it could come soon. And in that case, this recording, like all our recordings, would be our final word to you. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.